G'day, folks. Talk to Brendan Kumarasamy from Canada and his profession of being an effective communicator, and whether that's public speaking in front of a cast of thousands or in a meeting and just getting your point across. It's awesome. I want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here. And they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, we're rolling. Brendan Kumarasamy, thanks for jumping on board, bud, and having a yarn with us about your profession, the art of public speaking, mate.
Of course, happy to be on, Jake. Thanks for having me.
Mate, so I just want to jump into what drew you into the sector of public speaking, you know, where it all started out, and just the general art of it, mate. So if you want to jump in and kick it off from there, brother.
Of course, let's do it. So when I was in university, I used to do these things called case competitions. So think of it like professional sports, but for nerds. So in the same way, a lot of guys my age would watch sports like cricket or basketball or football or whatever sport you want. They'd either spend their time watching games or playing in games. Whereas me, I did the same thing in presentations. So I know this sounds completely foreign to most people, but people literally fly out to different countries around the world to present PowerPoint slides and to make people feel at home. A lot of the big case competitor universities in the world include UNSW, so the University of North South Wales in Australia, as well as the University of Melbourne. So those people, those business students in that, those faculties, fly out to Montreal every year, spend $10,000 to enter a competition, hotels, accommodations, everything is paid by their universities just to give PowerPoint slides.
Really?
Yeah, it's crazy. I know it sounds crazy, but it's true.
Yeah, well, you know, whatever floats your boat, and where if that's going to really make you an effective communicator, and, you know, because that makes a world of difference, especially when you're looking at some of the, you know, higher class organizations, whether it might be, say, the Apples of the world or the Googles, or where you've, you know, where you need to be an effective communicator when it's got to do with high class business or politics or whatever it may be, to make sure you get the strong communication lines across the board. So, you know, people are really digesting what you're putting across the line.
I appreciate that, man. So yeah, after I graduated from university, from that weird, amazing that I loved every second. It's why I know like 30 people in Australia, because they just keep coming to Montreal every year, new students. So I know a bunch, I should visit sometime anyways. So after I finished university, what happened was I started working in the corporate world, and I honestly loved my job. But what changed for me was, how do I use my time and expertise to make an impact? And that's where the idea for Master Talk came, because I was seeing all of these amazing presenters in my competition schools, but no one was creating public speaking content for the world. If you notice, a lot of the public speaking information on YouTube currently, it's frankly terrible. So I wanted to make a difference there.
Well, mate, it seems like you are. So, well, I shouldn't say seems. It looks, you know, it definitely looks like you are. So with your channel and you know, and it's good that, you know, you're taking all the tiny little facets of what it takes to put the language across the board, whether it be what's, you know, coming out verbally or some of the, where it's got to do with body language, like little things like that, just that holistically it encompasses everything that it takes to put across effective communication.
Absolutely, brother. Completely agreed.
So it drew you into this. So you've gone through uni and you're going around doing a lot of these PowerPoint presentations or getting into that, you know, into all of that within university itself. And that was Montreal. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. So what's the landscape of that across like Canada, because I'm thinking, you know, the other, like Toronto, Vancouver, some of the other major universities. So would there be, like, not just say, I'm thinking debating and effective communications along the line of that. So would you get drawn into that space as well?
Yeah, good question. So the way of looking at case competence, because I know it's bizarre for 99% of people out there, is that it's a subculture within a subculture. So it's mostly people in business school competing these things. And the reason why we do the competitions is to work at the companies you mentioned. So a lot of the companies like Google, Apple, but mostly the consulting firms, for those who are familiar with it who are listening, like McKinsey and Company, Bain and Company, Boston Consulting Group, these are cutthroat, really competitive companies to get into, like IBM and things like that. These case competitions are a feeder school for a lot of the people who end up getting there. So what the companies do is they sponsor the events. So they go this, so for example, I give you an example where UNSW actually did really well. So a couple of years ago, there was a case competition in Montreal. It's the same one every year. But the biggest case was sponsored by Walmart. But the person who gave the case isn't like a cashier at Walmart. It's the senior vice president of Walmart Canada. So he comes to the competition.
Yeah,
so we're 20. We're 21 years old. We're like 20 or something. And we're presenting in front of the senior VP. And we're just like, right? And you have, but these students are mind-blowing, though. So you have people like from Australia who fly incredible speakers, and you're sitting there wondering, like, how are these kids 20 years old? So that kind of gives you more a bit light of what these competitions are.
So they'll sponsor the event, but then obviously they'll see the people that the kids or whoever that really stands out, and exactly. Will they, and then they'll cherry pick some of these kids to say, hey, well, you know, once you finish your degree or wherever you may be, I think my iPhone was just coming through my headphones. Anyway, so they'll cherry pick some of the best kids that seem like really good, effective communicators, where they'll be like, when you finish your degree, hey, well, how about you come work for Walmart, IBM, whoever it may be, to come across the line and start spreading the gospel of whatever that company might be putting across the line, yeah?
If North South Wales in Australia, it's paying for students $10,000 in total to fund all of their travel. Those students are like the top five business students in the sea of hundreds of students in their university, right? So all of the students who come to the competition already have multiple job offers. So like when I graduated, I had probably three job offers waiting for me, but the only reason I didn't have more was because I just didn't apply to more companies because I already knew where I wanted to work. But this is just common. I know people have received, this 5-7 job offers, and they would just pick, because this is like the cream of the crop, right? But here's where the issue lies, to kind of tie this all together in a nice bow, as I should do as a communication guy, is most people are very talented at communication, Jake, usually don't teach it. So let's say, back to what you alluded to very well, let's say you work at Apple or Google. Well, if you're making multiple six figures, we're talking 200, 300 grand a year at these companies, why would you make free content? Why would you make YouTube videos? You're working 80 hours a week at work. You barely have time for your family. So when you're done out of work, you're going to picnics, you're doing parks, you're taking care of your kids if you have any. So you don't really have time for free content. But I became the exception to that rule because I'm very impact driven like you are. And I want to leave a legacy after I leave. I don't want to just work. And I love my job and I do well and I get paid for it. But beyond that, I was like, is there anything I could do? And I just went, oh, I should like make videos. That could be like a cool project. And then it just turned into something ridiculously a lot bigger than I thought it would be from the beginning. That's all.
And I love that. Want to leave a legacy, legacy structures, you know, you're going to put something in place where it's going to really make impact, you know, for the next generation coming through, Generation Z and everybody else that's going to be coming through the door of the next line of kids that are going to be cherry-picked. But what gave you the confidence? Where did that all come from? And did you know, because obviously you had a bit of time and a bit of to sort of build up those skills, whether it would have started out when you were real young, or did you get thrown into some sort of situation where it was sink or swim and thought, really, I need to work on this? Like, what got you to where you are today?
That's an excellent question. So the way that I kind of see this for people, because I know it seems like I'm the super confident guy. Now I got a YouTube channel, I got all this stuff, but it's definitely not where the story begins, right? So when I was 5 years old, my parents looked at me and they said, you know, we're going to put you in a French university, like a university at 5 years old, a French education system. Because in Montreal, it's one of the few cities in the world where you need to speak multiple languages to be successful. And French is a required language because everyone there speaks English and French. But here's the issue, Jake. I didn't speak French. So not only was I uncomfortable with presentations my whole life, elementary school and high school, but I had to give presentations in a language I didn't know. So when I was in grade, yeah, I was just like, what? You get the idea. Super panic, yeah. Lots of stress. Same thing when I started university. I came from a relatively poor family, not like desert poor or anything like that. But like, I didn't know anyone in the business world. Small joke I tell people for those who get it. PricewaterhouseCoopers is like this big accounting firm in the world. I thought it was a water bottling company when I started university. And I ended up working there for a couple of months after. But when I started, I thought it was, I was in my sweatpants and I go to the first information session. And the advisor looks at me and he's like, hey, Brendan, you should go like, you know, look at jobs. And I was like, I just started university, dude. I don't need to like, but anyways, I go there in my sweatpants and I'm sitting there in the back of the room. I'm just like, oh, this is not a water bottling company. This is like really serious. And like all of the students are in suits. I swear to God. The only suit I owned was this oversized Sears suit. For those who know, Sears is like this bankrupt retailer. This oversized. Yep. It's like $100. I wore it for prom. That was my only suit. So when I was networking, quote unquote, I didn't know what I was doing. I was just walking around with my oversized. Everyone was probably making fun of me in the background. Not in front of me, obviously. They were very nice because we're Canadian. But, you know, in the background they were. So let me tell you, belief and confidence is definitely, there's no tactic. There's no special trick that gets you out of it for sure. So let me shed some more light here. Confidence stems from two key areas. Mm. Preparation. And more importantly, a belief system. So let's talk about preparation because that one's easier to grasp. Mm. I obviously had a lot of insecurities when I started Master Talk. Remember, I was only 22 and I started a YouTube channel on public speaking information. That implies that I am saying to the world that I know as much as a PhD in communication.
That's it. You really got to, if you're putting that content out, you got to be able to back it up and really know what you're saying.
Exactly. So, but even when I started, sure, I'd coached a lot of people in my day and I was a damn good presenter. I'd presented hundreds of times by the time I started the YouTube channel, but I still had a lot of insecurities because I didn't have the societal credentials that were required or supposedly required in my head. But what gave me the confidence, because now today I'm 24 and I coach CEOs, right? So people kind of see the difference now, right? In the sense of when I started, yeah, I know you're just there like, what's going on? But trust me, when I started, same thing, what was going on? But what happened, what gave me the confidence was saying, sure, this guy has a PhD in communication, but he doesn't know anything about communication. I watched his YouTube videos and I just said, I'll give an example since we're having a pretty real conversation here. I'm not going to name him, but he had a video called How to Manage Vocal Tone. This is how the video went.
Come on, name and shame.
I love this. So he would say something. I love your energy at this early in the morning. You're awesome. But anyways, so he looks at the camera and he's like, hi, everyone. Today we're going to learn how to manage vocal tones. And I'm sitting there in my basement as a 22-year-old thinking, dude, you don't even know how to manage your own vocal tones. Why are you teaching other people?
He was just flat monotone, yeah?
Literally. I will show you. Like, just to show people I'm not BSing or anything, I will show you. So let's say you project an emotion like so. Sadness, happiness, excitement, or anger. It's easy. Well, it's not easy to project vocal tone, excuse me. But I mean in the sense, like, I can do it, right? I just did it in front of you.
Yeah.
The guy's a PhD, can't do it. So the key, the first part of confidence comes from preparation. There's no fake rule or thing that's going to help you gain confidence. But if you start at, like, podcasts is a good example. Sure, at the beginning, you're not an expert. You just you just want to share a platform with people. But after 100 episodes, Jake, you're an expert. Because an expert just means that you're a chapter ahead of the person that you're coaching. So if I'm getting started with the podcast and you've been doing it for 2 years, to me, you're the expert. Because there's something I can learn from you. So that's the first part with people. So this applies for anything, nothing serious. If you have a cupcake recipe that you just want to share with the world, you're a chapter ahead because you know the recipe and we don't. That's the first part. But the second part is much more important. A belief system. What does that mean? A belief system specifically means, what are you actually going to stand for? What kind of world are you trying to create? When you have something that you're willing to fight for, that gives you confidence. So every day, honestly, for the first 6 months, I thought Master Talk was a stupid idea. I thought no one was watching my videos. I had 10 subscribers. I still wanted to work at my corporate job and just keep doing that full time, be a senior executive and be like everyone else that I competed with in university, like everyone I did competitions with. But the thing, what happened was I started to develop a belief system. Not this whole, oh yeah, you know, I'm going to make money or anything. But what about 16-year-old Julia? Sure, some people could say I'm unqualified. Some people could say I don't have the credentials. But the more interesting side of the coin is, who's going to help 16-year-old Julia? Who's going to help any 16-year-old who wants to raise a bit of money for charity? Who wants to share a little presentation that they care about? And currently it's nobody.
That's a good point, especially with a lot of kids that when you're talking about 16-year-olds where confidence is key when it's around that time and you're talking about where they're going through high school and teenage angst and hormones and all that sort of stuff and where they're getting really judged, and especially in the world of social media today and where people are trying to stand out at that age, and when you're talking about a charity and where it's getting up in front of adults and family members and whoever it may be. And, you know, it's something that's really important when it's got to do about a charity that's going to help someone or whatever it may be. And you trying to get that point across. Because I know personally, you're talking about 16-year-old. I vividly remember the first time, like it's different with me now and with my job and what I do with public speaking and my confidence levels as an adult now compared to when I was 16. I know when I was in the library at high school at 16, I was even prepared to some degree. I had everything written out in front of me. But when I had to get up and start reading out, it was like another language was coming out. Like it was just mumbling and I'm like, what am I doing? And it was like as soon as I hit the stage, man, it was so daunting, and it wasn't in front of that many people, but it just struck me and I couldn't get out the words.
No, I completely understand where you're coming from. And frankly, like I personally coach a lot of kids myself, and it always, even for someone as supportive and energetic and open as me, there's still kids who cry in my class when they present, right? Even with me, even with the guy who's like, hey, don't worry, let's... Like, you know, I'm always happy all the time. You know, I'm always trying to be positive, even in that situation. So it's definitely an epidemic, right? That's why I kind of asked myself, what am I going to do? What is the choice? I'm at that crossroads. Do I say I don't have the confidence to do this Master Talk thing and I just go back to where I'm safe? Or do I say, despite my fear that I still have to this day that is never going to go away, do I still push forward anyways? Because, not because of some vanity metric or some I want to be famous, but because Julia needs me and every other little girl and boy who wants to master public speaking but obviously can't afford me can at least take advantage of the content so that every change maker in the world, whether they live in Cambodia, Australia, Montreal, wherever you want to be, can access those tools and share their ideas with the world.
That's great. And I want to talk about tools because there's so many tools when it comes to being an effective communicator. And just want to talk about the importance of body language and how you carry yourself. So in any situation to do with public speaking, to get, if it's talking in front of, you know, if it's within a meeting or you're on stage, how important is body language?
Yes. So I'm a very counterintuitive guy, Jake. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to focus on religion rather than tactics. Because I know we have all these body language experts. But by religion, I don't mean religious. I mean, what's the mantra here? What are we supposed to actually focus
on?
That's what I meant. Yeah, don't worry. Not to Christianity or something. No, that's what I mean. So let's start the question here. Number one. Why are we scared of public speaking? Why is this happening? For some reason, we're all afraid. You just gave your story. I gave mine. So why is this occurring?
Just hold on. Hold on 2 seconds. We'll start off again on that question. Hey, Amy, can you quickly come here, please? Yeah. Just grab my iPhone, can you?
Who's Amy?
That's my wife. Oh. Just grab my phone. Just turn it on for a tick. Take the Bluetooth off it. Come here. Yeah, come here. Righto. Sorry about that, brother. Just these Bluetooth that was kicking into the headphones. And I'm like, Jesus, I forgot.
No worries, brother.
Okay, it's disconnected. There we go. Thank you.
Are we good? Can I?
Yeah, you're good.
Awesome. So, like I was saying, Jake, instead of focusing on tactics, let's focus on the religion. Like, what's actually the foundational skills that we need to be focusing on with public speaking? So, the first question that we need to ask ourselves is the simple one. Why are we all scared of public speaking? No one even fathoms the question. We're all afraid. We don't understand why. So let's dive into this. Most of the presentations, if not all of the presentations we've given our lives, are almost entirely in the classroom setting. That's where the culprit is. We don't wake up one morning and go, hey, Jake, you want to get breakfast and present all day, mate? I'm like, no, that doesn't make any sense, right? What we do is we're in history class, me and you in high school. Teacher comes up to us, says, well, Jake, Brenda, I need you to do a presentation on the Renaissance. And you're just there like, what is this, like a fruit? Then you figure out later it's a time period in history. But the point is simple. Three things happen when we present in high school, college, university, wherever have you. We never get to pick the topic. They always give it us. You know, it's history class, Jake. You do this history thing. It's math class, Jake. You do the math thing. It's science class, etc. Two. Students don't care about what you have to say. Not because they hate you, not because they don't like you, not because they're judging you, because they're thinking about their own presentation. Oh no, I got to give a presentation in 5 minutes. They're not paying attention to you. Why would they?
That's so true. Just having that inner dialogue of they're so worried of what they're going to look like to, you know, their peers and how they're going to be verbally putting across. Is it going to be verbal diarrhea? Where is this going to go? So
you got it exactly. And the third thing is you have a teacher who's really smart, very well intentioned, well educated, but super stressed. She or he is managing 30 presentations in 2 classes. They're checking boxes, they're figuring out how to navigate the curriculum and getting this thing done. The last thing they're doing is looking at how you're presenting, giving you feedback and how to be more inspiring. So when you're not picking the topic, you have audiences who don't care that you keep presenting in front of, because you don't just present in history, you present everywhere. Psychology, maths, English, science, list goes on. No wonder we're scared of public speaking, Jake. No wonder. We're not looking at public speaking as a way to scale our ideas, as a way of making a difference. We're looking at it like a chore, a responsibility, an obligation, something that we don't want to do. In contrast with what you're doing, because this podcast, you're seeing public speaking as a positive, because you're thinking, hey, if I communicate better, I can be a better host, I can do a better job with my guests, I can share better information. That doesn't apply in the classroom.
That's right, mate. So, and yeah, that's good when you're talking about where it is a chore, where it is an obligation, and where, because that's just going to be a different mindset of, you know, if that's the kid within high school, within, or if that's, say, young Brendan, when that's in university and where you're just getting the certain topic that's forced on you that you're going to try and put out to in university. That's a whole nother, you know, and whole nother kettle of fish there when you're talking about probably 400 plus kids that you got to give a presentation to. So, but I want to jump into where you talked about French in Montreal. You got to throw another language out there. So I want to talk about, so the different, the approach that you take. So, you know, when you got Montreal, Canada, those parts of the country, you know, they're multicultural, just like Australia is over here, or a pretty multicultural country. So when it's got to do with the approach of different cultures, and because different people from different cultural settings are going to have, you know, different mindsets or different approaches. So can you take us through that? Because you might be in front of a crowd where you're like, they're going to take this differently, or where the majority of the crowd are from this cultural setting or background. And how do you approach that?
Of course. Great question. So I was lucky. I'm fortunate that I was able to be exposed to so many international teams because of the nature of the competitions I did, because 19 different countries would come up from around the world to present, whether it's Germany, Australia, all the way to from the States. The way that you want to think about this is actually not that difficult. The strategy is simple. Let's say you have to present to a new culture in a different country. All you have to do is get into a conversation with somebody who understands both your culture and the culture you're trying to speak to. So I'll give you an example. Let's say that I'm coming to Australia to give a keynote to 100 executives, but I've never been to Australia and I don't know the differences in the questions. So for example, when you say mate a lot, we don't do that in Canada, right? So I have to, but I got used to it because I speak to a lot of Australians, but not at the beginning, right? So what I would do is I would ask a culture buddy. So me and you would get a coffee, someone who understands both my culture and yours. And I would just ask you a bunch of questions, and I can say whatever I want because, you know, I'm not trying to be offensive. I'm just trying to understand the culture. But the executives, if I ask them, they might think I'm being offensive, right? But if I just ask you and I just go, what's the difference? And you go, oh, this is what we do differently. And I'll do the same thing with someone in my own country who's from Australia or who knows someone in Australia. So that way they can talk in both modes. So they can say something like, well, I know in Canada you do this, Brendan, but in Australia, you can't do that. And then I would just ask you a bunch of questions and adjust my presentation. So I've done that a lot. Here's a quick, super easy example. So when I talk about soccer in the UK, for those who aren't familiar,
football.
You got it, right? So the term is football. Whereas when I speak to American audiences, because I use sports as an example for another analogy we can talk about today. Mm. But the idea is, I can't say soccer. They don't know what that is. So I have to say, oh, well, when you're speaking on your footy, professional footy team, and then they get it. But I don't know that because I have to actually force myself to say that because I'm used to the word soccer. Those are some examples that someone from your culture and the culture you're speaking to can help you navigate.
Yeah, that makes sense. And especially when it's easy to digest when, you know, sport as a whole across, you know, different countries, and that's an easy way to bridge across to different cultures. But it would be tricky too when you're talking about setting different modes, because where you're going to have to change gears when, because say when you're talking about how people might structure sentences and just that the way that they talk. So that's when you'd have to adapt and sort of, you know, you're you and the way that you present, but it's just cherry picking little bits here and there. Like say when you talk, having that conversation with your Australian friend, of how you can sort of slip in little, like you're almost like planting the seeds in a way, like to the crowd, yeah?
Absolutely, exactly. And by cherry picking, what this allows you to do, which is a key concept in presentations, is what we call audience obsessiveness. So most people think about their audience. So me, you, somebody else, we're like, oh, I wonder who I'm presenting to. But the best speakers in the world obsess over their audience. They don't just think about their audience, they talk to them. So by talking to them, by understanding their psychology, by understanding what their wants, needs, dreams, inspirations are, that's how we can tailor our presentation at a 1% level. And once again, I'll give you an example to demonstrate this. A lot of speech coaches, when they give workshops and public speaking, when they sell their services, this is how it goes. Jake, did you know that the greatest fear after death is public speaking? So when you have someone like me who actually knows public speaking, when he's examining this type of document, that doesn't make sense to me. Because when I talk to my audience, they're scared. They're worried. They don't think they can be good speakers. And my goal is to inspire them to be great speakers.
That's it.
Right? So the last thing I want to talk about is death. I don't even want to utter the word. Like, glossophobia is the medical term for public speaking fear. I wouldn't, none of that terminology, that garbage that we don't need, frankly, is in any of my videos because they're not necessary for the outcome I'm trying to achieve. But most speaking coaches don't even go that far in their analysis, and frankly, it frustrates me. But that's an example of obsessing over your audience.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. Obsessing over your audience and trying to tap in and know the psychology, just the base level. So where this rolls into what is really important when it's got to do with, you know, public speaking, or just when you're talking to, it might be a group of friends, where it's keeping people engaged. So when you're, well, it's better off in the public speaking realm. So when you're doing a presentation, because I've seen this so many times when I've been at different conferences, when you'll have a public speaker up there and you'll have someone that absolutely crushes it. They got the people engaged. Everybody's listening, cheering, you know, carrying on. And then you'll have the next speaker up and you're hearing crickets in the room and people are falling asleep. So what is key to keeping people engaged in what you're trying to put across? Even if it's something that's not so exciting, the topic on what you're trying to say, but how you can really, you know, elevate it to keep people excited and engaged on what you're putting across.
Absolutely. The answer is a lot simpler than you think. So here's the tie-in with keeping your audience engaged. Present the same presentation hundreds of times. Let me explain why. Most of us don't know how to practice public speaking because it's not taught in school. So I'll explain that for people. Let's say when you learn a new skill, whether it's podcasting, playing a new sport, learning a new instrument, whatever have you, even if the skills are different, the tactics are the same. So I'll use piano here to demonstrate this. So when you play piano and you try it for the first time, sure, you can try 10, 15 songs that you like. But if you're an absolute beginner, you want to get that first win really quickly. So by knowing how to play one song, not only would you feel confident, but you can show off that song to the world. You're like, look, guys, I know how to play piano. Everyone's going, wow, look at Jake. It's awesome. So then when you have that small confidence boost, then you go and master all the other songs. Same thing with podcasting. You do the first one, not so good. Second one, oh, you know, I forgot to record it. Then after 100, you're like, yeah, now I know what I'm doing. Now I know what's happening.
It's true.
And then you gain confidence. So it's small incremental steps, but the steps are always the same. Do the small thing over and over and over again. Play the same song 50 times. Do the same podcast episode 100 times, and then you get it. But we don't apply that logic to presentations.
No.
Right? It's Wednesday. Our boss, our client, our teacher gives us a presentation to give for Friday. Hey, Jake, can you get this done? And you're just like, yeah, sure. So you punch away at the computer. And then evenings, you don't talk to your wife. You don't talk to anybody. Then Friday, you're exhausted. You give the presentation and you crumble it up, throw it in the garbage, and move on to the next one. The reason we can't make our audience engaged is not because we're not engaging. It's because we're not spending enough work going through one presentation a lot. My keynote, to kind of close a point on this, I've presented now over 300 times. Not 3, not 30, not 50, 300. That's the obsessiveness it takes to engage your audience.
So before you got number one, before you kick off number one, Jesus, 300. So with the first one, before you do that, are you doing any techniques at home? Are you sort of, what are you running through? Is Brendan looking in the mirror and giving it, you know, and having that conversation with himself of getting it across the board and just seeing what little things that you can pick on within yourself before you go and hit the stage for that first presentation?
Well, I always like, I'm very straight shooter, as you probably caught on in this episode. I'm not a big fan of short fixes. But what I will say, look, the first time I gave that speech, I sucked. Okay. That's coming from the guy who had 500 presentations on his belt. But to conventional, to people who aren't used to public speaking, I was probably good to great, to be honest. I'm just being very self-critical. Like, it was good, but it wasn't like mind-blowing, like I would hope it is today after 300 shots at the barrel here. But I think the idea is simple. The fundamental question you ask yourself is not, what's that simple trick? What's that simple ritual? Though I have my rituals and I can share it, even if it won't apply to people. Mm. I think the simple trick, or the real trick, is the following when you build your keynote. If it was your last presentation and your audience only remembers one sentence, they won't remember your name. They won't remember your accomplishments. They won't remember who you are. They won't even remember what you say. They'll only remember one sentence. What do you want the sentence to be? And that sentence, if you ever find it one day, that is your key idea. And from that key idea, you build your whole pitch around that, on how to defend that tooth and nail. So for me, the idea is simple. I fundamentally believe in a world where public speaking can be exactly taught like leadership. We know that leaders are not born, but rather created. It's obvious. We don't come out of a womb being a leader. We go through hardships in our life. We learn very valuable lessons, pain, suffering, and we become great leaders.
Yes.
That needs to apply for public speaking as well.
Yeah, 100%. And that's what does carve up a person too, when they've dealt with a bit of adversity, and where that might build up an individual, where it does give them the confidence to get certain techniques and just general confidence as a whole to get over what they want to speak about and hit the stage, hit it ground running, and just put across what their, whatever it may be that they want to speak about. But what's also daunting to a lot of people, and where I've seen this happen before, whether it's in a meeting or whether it is talking in front of 100 people, where someone just gets pulled aside and it's the spontaneous talk. It's something that someone's got to think of on the fly. They're not prepared, but it's like, righto, you're going to give a speech in 2 minutes. So you want to sort of gear this up because you're going to throw this out within a minute or two. So get the confidence up, get this up and running, which is daunting as, which is, because I'm just thinking of positions I've been in before. But anyway, where it's pretty scary, you know. So what's some good techniques that Absolutely. You want to build up within, righto, let's hit it, let's do it?
Yeah, so for impromptu speech, I can give a bit more tactics here because it's something you can implement every day. So let's play this out just so your audience knows what we're trying to do here. So the exercise is called the random word exercise. Jake, give me a random word, any word.
A random word?
That I understand. Don't use like Australian slang or else I won't get it, but something like it.
Okay. Adversity.
I like that. So what I have to do now with that word is I need to create an introduction out of thin air. So what? Here I go. In our lives, things happen. It's a journey like any other, much like obstacles, challenges, adversities that we face. The ones who achieve success, the ones who achieve great things in our lives, are able to overcome those adversities and overcome those barriers. I remember when I was a kid, I struggled so much with public speaking that I wanted to throw up. In fact, I threw up many times because I had to present in a language that I didn't know. But by overcoming that adversity, it taught me valuable lessons. like the power of sharing my ideas with the world and the insight that if we're going to be alive once, we might as well do something amazing regardless, because anything worth doing has its adversity. So overcome yours. Notice how I just invented that out of thin air. So how was I able to do that?
Boom, you done well there, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It wasn't perfect, but you know, it gives people an idea. So let's break down what I did there. So what you want to do to practice, then we'll get into tactics, is every day for 5 minutes, because I don't want people to compare themselves to me. I've been doing this since I was 19, right? So it's been 5 years now since I've been speaking professionally, pretty much. And I've done that exercise probably almost 1,000 times now, literally, right? So what I recommend people do is every day, 5 minutes, not 5 hours, five words, 5 minutes. So literally what you do is you walk around your house, you pick an object, you go bear. I remember I was at a toy store once. I picked up a teddy bear and blah, blah, blah. Do it again. 5 words, or perhaps your wife or somebody else give them if you want an extra challenge. And if you do that every day for 3 months, you'll be so discomforted trying to figure out speeches out of thin air that when you go back to your presentation that you're preparing for, it's going to be a joke. That's the number one tactic. Now let's dive into something a bit deeper with impromptu. What are the 3 things that I'm doing that I just demonstrated in this video? There's one overarching idea with impromptu, so a non-prepared speech where you just have to give it right away, is the following. I don't know what I'm going to say as much as you do. I'm not smarter than you. I'm not more special. I'm not more important. But through my way of speaking, I'm going to convince you that I do, so that with practice, you will too. So there's 3 things that I do here. One is my face doesn't look like I'm scared. So I couldn't have known what word you could have gave me. You could have given me, some people give me like cucumber, they'll give me blanket or something random. But I have to give the illusion through my face by looking happy as I'm presenting it, or sad depending on the emotion, that I'm not afraid, as if I'm an expert on adversity. That's the first thing. Second thing is I need to maintain my eye contact even if I don't know what I'm going to say next. So even if I don't know what's happening out of my mouth, I still have to keep looking at Jake to convince Jake that I do know what I'm going to say next. And the last thing that I do is I use pauses, not to add emphasis to my presentation, which is great, but to buy time.
True.
Like True. I just did right now.
That is important, news and silence, and how you can manipulate that to move on to your next section of what you're going to talk about, yeah?
Absolutely. So here's a small trick for people that kind of ties in with everything we talked about. A secret that the best speakers in the world don't tell us, that I'll tell you, is that we can pause forever without making it seem awkward. Obviously, we don't have forever, but you take my word for it. But what I do at workshops, when there's like 10 or 15 people, I literally freeze for 2 minutes and I just stare at everyone for 10 seconds each just to prove my point.
That's awkward.
Not for me, though. Not because I'm special, because I've done it so many times. So when you get to that level, right, because I just practiced a lot, then when obviously you're not pausing for 2 minutes in your presentations, but when you get to the actual presentation, you can pause for 3 seconds, 2 seconds, 5 seconds, or in an impromptu speech, you can pause for 4 or 6 seconds and not make it look awkward, so you can buy time to figure out, what am I supposed to say here? Like I just did in that exercise.
Yeah, that's great. And talking about exercises, like, because, and this is what I was thinking to myself when I was going to jump on these podcasts, don't be every second word go, he's going to pull you up on this.
So many people are self-conscious with the interview. I wonder why.
it's just something that I always have when I speak. And this is, I've practiced it a bit within my own internal dialogue when I've gone to do presentations, is just because I'm a stickler for it. And when I see people in the public realm doing it, whether it's politicians or whoever it may be, just saying every second word in your speech. How do you, when you're saying and talking about what you want to put across, how do you have that internal dialogue not to say or ah all the time? How do you practice on taking that out of your vocabulary?
Yeah, it's not easy. Let me start by saying that it took me a couple of months before I got rid of all of mine. But the tactic is going to be important for your audience. So what you want to do is, even if you say gibberish, your priority needs to get rid of ums and ahs. So let's say I'm coaching somebody on ums and ahs specifically, and their presentation literally sounds something like this. And they're like saying randomness, like complete randomness, but they're not saying ums and ahs. I give them full marks, right? So let's say this is how the practice starts, by the way. So let's say when I was used to practice, this is what my presentation sounded like. Good afternoon to the board of directors. My name is, I should probably know this. My name is, all right, Brendan, right? But you get the idea. Notice I'm cutting a lot in between my sentences. So that's going to happen a lot when you're practicing removing your ums and ahs. And you, when you're practicing this, you shouldn't care about your content. You're only focused on getting rid of the ums and ahs. And if you do that, you win the exercise. Here's a good analogy that explains this. Public speaking is like juggling 18 balls at the same time. What you want to do to because when you get to my level, you're able to juggle all 18 at the same time, right? Ums and ahs, silences, eye contact, audience mastery, blah, 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 blah. But let's not get intimidated by all that. Juggle one at a time. Start with silences and dominate silences. Then go on to eye contact and say, hey, I can stare at Jake without making it look awkward. Good. Now I'm juggling two balls. My audience master, I'm talking to my audience and getting to three balls. Then you get to ums and ahs. And you go, okay, I have these three balls figured out. I'm just focusing on the fourth ball. I'm not focusing on being like this Tony Robbins S speaker. I'm just focused on ball number four. That's it. And that's what I did. Ball one, two, three, and eventually I had all 18 in the air. That's what you want to do.
Nice, nice. And when you're talking about having balls up in the air, because there's so many factors of and facets of what comes of public speaking and what you can utilize as tools. So what have you learned from the open environment when it's got to do with nothing, with public speaking, and where you've used that and where it's been able to, you've been able to utilize that as a tool to push that out into the world of public speaking?
Yeah, so what I've done differently than I think most people in my space is I try and draw analogies to your point on things that have nothing to do with public speaking to make it easier for people to digest, like I do with the juggling example. Here's my favorite one. If I were to compare public speaking to anything, it would be a puzzle, like a 1,000-piece puzzle. So if I asked you, Jake, for the sake of the conversation, if we were making a puzzle together, which pieces would you start to work on first and why?
What puzzles would I work on first and why when it's
So let's say you
good?
have a so let's say you have a puzzle. It doesn't matter what the puzzle is. Which pieces would you start with?
The piece that I would start with to do with speaking is just the fear factor of how are you going to deal with, are you going to be able to open your mouth, speak? Are you going to be able to, where's the confidence? Haven't Confidence would be the first one. That'd be the first piece of the puzzle. Bang. Where are you going to find that? And then the rest is going to follow.
I love that. But what I was alluding to is an actual puzzle, like an actual jigsaw puzzle, right? So let's say you got a bunch of little pieces, like actually on a table, and you're working on a family. What you normally start with, and you know this, is you start with the edges, right? Because all the because it's because they're corner pieces, they're much easier to figure out. Public speaking works in the same way. Most people don't spend enough time intentionally thinking about how they start and how they end. So this is the result. They shove a bunch of content, and then when they get to their next slide or their last one, they go, blah, blah, blah. Oh yeah, this is my last slide. Thanks. That's how it ends. So puzzles is a good analogy. In the same way you start with the edge pieces, you want to get the start and the end sorted out immediately. Then after, you want to conquer the middle together. Working on a presentation alone is boring. I don't do that, and I don't understand why most people do it. And I think the reason is because we don't have enough support group in that space. So what I do is, in the same way that when you're working on a puzzle, oh, Jake, I'll work on the sun pieces, you work on the mountains, and then we'll bring them all together. I get a lot of feedback on how I present the middle. So what I do, to give your audience a pro trick, is I record the entire presentation. I send it to 25 people. And what I do is I specifically ask those 25 people to give me time-stamped feedback. So what does this mean? It means you don't just say, oh, Brendan, that was good or bad. You say, Brendan, go to 5 minutes, 30 seconds. What you did there, you're too sad, but you're presenting something really exciting. You should change that. But when 25 people are looking at your presentation that way, let's just say the second version of your presentation is going to be 100 times better.
Yeah. Yep. 100%. And so 1,000 times better when you're talking about, you know, you're starting off on your first and second, building confidence up, and you get better and better. So how do you get better and better when you're looking at different mediums of when it's, say, teleconferences, or if it's in the world of now what we're doing now through, if it's Zoom, Skype, the whole virtual world, and the strategies that you build up for that? Because that's a little bit tricky when you can't, when social cues are a little bit harder, when it's got to do with the virtual space. So what's the process in going into the virtual world of Zoom, Skype, or teleconferences and those different mediums, and still how to get people engaged, how to build the confidence up? Because that's a whole nother ball game.
Completely agree. So the way that you want to think about this is you want to be an expert in one, not many, because being an expert in one allows you to be a generalist in everything. Let me explain that again. Being a specialist in one allows you to be an expert in everything. So when I started, I was just doing presentations. And then after, as you know, I went on camera. Even if I never wanted to be a YouTuber, the only reason I wanted to was because I needed to teach the world public speaking. And the only way to do that is through video, because I couldn't fly out to Australia every week and coach everybody there, right? I needed to make videos for people. So when that happened and I transitioned, I sucked on camera. I was terrible. Even with 500 presentations under my belt, I was alone. I was in my basement. It was dark. I had no money to make videos. It was frankly depressing and I hated it, to be honest. But I got better at it like everyone else. And I was able to speed up my learning much faster than any normal person because I just had the work ethic from my 500 presentations. I just presented 500 times on camera in a year. That's all I did. Then after a year, obviously, it went from, hi, everyone, my name is Brendan, and this is awkward, to, did you know, you know, so you get better over time. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, how do we present an online presentation specifically, as you mentioned? The first thing is by acknowledging how difficult they are. I get it. Online presentations are much more challenging than offline ones, and I'll explain why. And with a simple example. Exactly. So I'll give you an example. Let's say you say a joke in person. I'm either funny or I'm not. So you're either going to look at me, Jake, and go, oh, haha, you know, Brendan's funny. You're going to say, this guy is not funny. But you're going to make a decision. It's one or the other, and I'll know. If I'm not funny, I won't say a joke next time. And if I am funny, then I'll write it down and say it again. But here's the issue with online presentations. You need to say the joke and assume it's funny. Why is that? Because I don't see how Jake reacts to me anymore. There's 30 people on a screen and my whole screen is just my slides. I don't know how Jake is reacting. So I have to say the same joke with the same level of confidence, enthusiasm, and energy as I would have if you were in the same room. In the same way with this conversation, I need to assume like we're long lost friends, or else the conversation that we're having, because we're just met, will be super weird and awkward, right? So in other words, what I'm saying is the trick and the remedy is you always want to bring it back to why you're giving the presentation in the first place. And obviously it helps if you've given the presentation before in person, because a lot of my presentations are just my keynotes now virtually. So it's easier for me to execute online. But the idea is simple here. If I'm imagining Jake in my audience, and I know Jake can take away a lot from my presentation on communication or baking or rowing or whatever you're passionate about, I can speak more to that person. In the same way, before I come on to this podcast, I think to myself, hey, you know, Jake is working really hard with this podcast. He's taking time out of his busy life, his mornings, to come here and speak to me and commit a lot of time to this. So it's my moral responsibility to give him my best, even if I don't know him. So when you can get to that place.
And I'll appreciate that, brother.
Of course, of course. So by just acknowledging that other person and showing what the other person is doing, even if you don't know them, you can say, oh, wait, no, I actually do know them because we're on the same team. We're both trying to make an impact here. It's just in different countries and different places and different areas, but it's all the same thing. So now when I'm speaking to you, it's as if I already know you. So the mindset is completely different.
Yeah, 100%. So when this is a daunting phase for many people that get up on stage, when you're dealing with, depending on, say, if it's a topic that might have, that might trigger certain people in the crowd, you're going to have disgruntled folk in there. You might have hecklers. People might get a bit holistic. I mean, they might get a bit hostile, sorry, and they might get up and carry on, point, wave, and go, that's not right, Brendan, you know, blah, blah, blah. How do you try and level out the crowd if they're going to carry on like turkeys?
Let's play this out. Okay, take it from an old guy like me, right? Is presented hundreds of times. Yeah, very old. In presentation age, I'm probably like 80 now with after all the presentations I've done. There is not a single presentation. I'm honest. There is not a single time in any of those hundreds of presentations where anyone has ever heckled at me. They've asked me hard questions. But that's very different. Very different than heckling. Let's compare the two. Heckling,
if you had someone that's tried to throw a question, trying to catch you out at a certain topic that you're talking about, yeah?
Sort of, but once again, it's how you view it, right? So I've definitely gotten hard questions, but here's, let's kind of look at that question from two points of view, right? So the first point of view is we think, what is this person doing? Why are they interrupting me? This is not fair. You suck, right? That's just what average speakers think. But we're not average. We're much better than that. The other perspective is this person is very engaged in our content. They're actually listening when they don't have to. Hurrah! You have participation. Why is this a bad thing? Secondly, if they ask you a question and you don't know the answer, I'll be straight up honest and say, because we're having a real conversation here, that's your fault, not theirs. You're the expert of the subject.
That's right.
So be honest. And obviously you don't need but let's bring this another way. If you're an introvert and you don't like questions at the beginning, just be upfront with it. Remember, you're the presenter. You control the outcomes. So I coach a lot of people to just say, hey everyone, I'm going to save a lot of questions until the end just to go through my webinar and my keynote. And you can ask me questions at the end. I do it all the time. When I'm in person, I personally like the chaos. So I would say, go, just ask me questions. It's fine. I like keeping it interactive.
I love that. See, that's what I'm all about too, like taste the fear. Just jump in, into the deep end, see if you can, you know, either sink or swim. And, you know, because that really builds up like who you are as a person, where it instills confidence and where you can take, for me, like take ownership if it's of that crowd and the direction of where you might, if you do have these people that they're throwing the hard line questions at you, at the end of the day, you're spot on. You're going to be the expert. You're going to be able to handle those questions and know what the actual topic is and know the technicalities to say, righto, they're going to throw that at me. I can roll with this question and then take the negatives out of it and push the positives onto it and then move on to the next question or carry on with your presentation. Is that safe to say?
Absolutely. And just to give another pro tip, if that's something that really bothers you, like for people who are listening, what I like to do for really important keynotes, now this is like probably 5% of the time. The other 95, I'm speaking to people I'm generally used to, people I know. But if it's like a executive team that I haven't met yet, what I do is I bulletproof my presentation. So I get a bunch of people that I hate who are my friends. A bunch of people that I hate. So just, I'm just kidding. People I love, but who aren't afraid to tell me the truth. That's what I really mean.
Nice.
And what they do is they gun me down in presentations. So what they do they literally shred me. So when my presentation is over, they go to slide two. What did you mean here? What did you mean here? What did you mean there? And they just roast me for 2 hours. But after they're done and the damage has been done, there was no question in the world that I can get that will bother me. Now, this, like when I started speaking, to be honest, Jake, when it was keynote number one, I was nervous. I don't know. I knew half, I knew like 10% of what I know today about communication. Because remember, at the beginning, I was great at speaking. I wasn't good at coaching. I was just getting started. But now you can ask me anything about public speaking, any curveball or anything. And I'll know, not because I'm smart, not because I'm more special than people, just because I've done it 300 times now. So that's why the importance, to reemphasize this point further, that's why you want to present something repeatable, so that when after you've done it 100 times, you just have that confidence, that oomph, that you just can't get anywhere else.
Yeah, 100%. So who benefits mostly off your skill set? I'm talking individual businesses, whatever it may be, and what type. And where does most of your business flow when you're going out there, and where people are tapping into Brendan and, hey, we need you?
Absolutely. So I'm very fortunate, Jake, in the sense that speaking coaches don't have to push really hard for clients if they're really good at what they do. I like to think I am. Hopefully I've proven that. Who knows? But
no, you go all right, mate. You go all right. Young, articulate man. You're doing all right, brother.
I appreciate it, brother. The support is always nice to have. Yeah. But anyway, so because of that, and because public speaking coaching, for those who aren't aware, is extremely exhausting. When you're working with one-on-one with people and you're getting their message together, it can be very daunting. So because of that, I'm extremely picky about the people I work with one-on-one. There are usually people who are very high-level executives who have a big movement or a following or a mission. So more so mission, not necessarily following count, but like, I'll give an example. So one of my clients is a speaker. So she shares her message with the world, right? She goes on stages and things like that. So for me, that's a very fulfilling client to work with, because she takes all my advice. She pays me really well. And she frankly is purpose-driven. I would not work with a vice president of a bank or something. It's not my thing. But okay, unless it's like a workshop setting. So if it's a workshop, like let's say I'm presenting to a bunch of vice presidents at the same time, which I've done, right? But then in those situations, I'm not tied to any specific person. So I don't mind just giving a general workshop for everybody. Mm. But I would say most of the people who ask me for like services are usually CEOs of companies, like tech entrepreneurs, sometimes podcasters, people who have a big game. They want to play like a very big game. And so when they're playing a huge game, they don't mind spending big bucks on a speech coach, because they make back the money really fast after a presentation or two.
Yeah, very important. So any hot tips in generalized speaking, whether it doesn't matter if it's the kid at school, if it's the CEO of a tech company, and anybody in between. So bang, shoot, hot tips, brother, put them out there. Without giving too much of your sauce away.
No. My philosophy in life, Jake, hence once I go on so many of these, is I share all my content for free, because my real ideal client is not the CEO. I work with them. I'm blessed. I'm fortunate. You know, I have that abundance. But the reason I started MasterDoc has nothing to do with those clients. It has everything to do with helping the people who can't afford me, which is probably a lot of people who are listening, which is fine, right? My mission in life is to be the number one speaking coach in the world, not because of ego, not because I want to be number one, because I want you to know who I am. So if you want to share your ideas with the world, you can listen to all my free content, because I share everything for free.
Legacy. Like
exactly, right? I want to just leave everything for the next generation. What the heck am I going to do keeping all this in my head? And, you know, I don't mind selling myself out, as long as I can share everything else for free for everyone else. In the same way that Seth Godin is someone I respect a lot. Just for people who don't know, because I always like shouting him out. Seth Godin gets paid $150,000 a speaking engagement. He has zero incentive, zero, to share any free content with anybody now. He has nothing to lose. He has a net worth of like $30, $40 million now. So why does he still write a blog every day? He has been writing a blog every day since 1989. He has been writing blog Christmas, New Year's Eve for longer than I've been alive. Isn't that crazy?
That's
so guys like that, that's the kind of person I'm trying to be. Sure, obviously, if you want to get, he doesn't even do one-on-one anymore. But for that kind of person who cares so much about legacy, who cares so much about sharing his knowledge with the next generation, that's what this is about. So my only hot tip for all of you, because you can watch all my videos on Master, they're all free. The only tip that matters for you that's listening is the following. Be insane or be the same. If you want to be like everyone else, that's totally fine. You want to get a 9-to-5 job, you want to do all the conventional stuff society tells you to do, that's cool. But if you're listening to this, you probably want to do something different. You probably want to make an impact on the world. My advice is the only way you're going to get there is by being a bit more insane. What does that mean? It means that every single person that I know of who has made a big impact in the world, whether it's waking up at 7 a.m. like you have for this show, or whether it's me starting a YouTube channel at 22 on public speaking, everybody who does something important is fundamentally insane to most people. So start by communicating the weird things that you do with everyone that isn't illegal to remind yourself that you are different, that you're meant to do something important. And I'll close with this. I am literally the only six-figure earner that you will ever meet, Jake, who is literally sitting on his mattress in his basement, in his mother's basement, who doesn't own a car. So why in the world does this make any sense? Every decision I just told you, and I don't plan on moving out of my mom's house until I'm 30. So how did all of these decisions I just told you make no sense to the average human being? Brendan makes a lot of money. Why does he just move out? Why does he just stay home? Because the only thing that matters to me, because I understand what I like and I questioned everything in my life, is making Master Talk successful. I'm obsessed, right? So find that obsession for you. Is it a cupcake recipe? Is it a podcast? Just find it and do it. That's basically my message.
Beautiful, sir. You hit the nail on the head right there. And mate, that was poetry in motion right there. So, mate, ending on that note, and I really appreciate you coming on and having a yarn, having a talk with us about public speaking. It's very important. And especially in this medium now where through Zoom, through Skype, whatever it may be, of being an effective communicator, getting your point across. And so how can people get a hold of you? Or, you know, and just throw everything out in the atmosphere, you know, Master Talk, your social media, whatever it may be, if people want to get a hold of you and just see what Brendan Kumarasamy is up to and his expertise in public speaking.
Of course.
Yeah.
Like I said, I'm not famous like Jake or anything. So feel free to just message me on Instagram at Master Your Talk. I'm very easy to find. I answer all my DMs. So don't be shy to connect with me. Comments, you know, what you liked about this episode, insults. I'm always open to new ideas. Don't be shy to just throw that over. And if you want to check out my YouTube channel, it's Master Talk in one word. So you can learn everything that I coach my clients on for free.
Righto, folks. You heard the man. If you want to get amongst public speaking and everything to do about building up your confidence and talking and hit the stage running, Master Talk. Get onto his YouTube channel, subscribe, have a look, and that's where it's all at. That's where the content is at, to build up the confidence and, you know, to be like Brendan. Have a crack, have a go. That's what it's all about, tasting the fear. Love it, mate. All right. Have a good one, brother.
You too. Thanks so much for your time.
Cheers. See, that's the foundation, the groundwork of what it takes to be an effective communicator. And if you want to see more of Brendan's work, he's got a YouTube channel called Master Talk with all different types of scenarios on how to be an effective communicator. Recommend it. Check it out. Do it. And if you want to get in contact with me, you can get me via Instagram at StreetRollingCheetah or email one word, StreetRollingCheetah@gmail.com. Or we've also got a Facebook page, Keep Rolling with Jake Briggs, so check it out. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe button. It'd be much appreciated. And I want to thank our sponsors, Permabil Australia, greatest electrical chairs in the land. wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here, and they got great assistive tech also. So righto, see you on the next one.